Filipinos with food and those without. Today, Monday, November 18th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Some Philippine survivors are now getting food aid, but others are still without, and Filipinos in London worry.
Wasting food here, and people there are all hungry, us just like in tears every day. It's overwhelming.
And later, it's Sisi fever in Egypt.
Chocolates with Sisi's face on it. People who put up portraits of Sisi on their taxi cabs and in front of their homes. People even naming their children Sisi.
Plus, 100 grand for a fungus?
Technically, it's an underground mushroom. But for everybody, it's a smell, a unique, fantastic smell.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. How a leader responds to a disaster is always significant. Remember President George W. Bush and Hurricane Katrina, or Prime Minister Naoto Kan of Japan and his awkward handling of the tsunami and Fukushima meltdown? So now when President Benigno Aquino of the Philippines goes to the center of Typhoon Haiyan's destruction in Tacloban and says he's not leaving until his people are safe, it's worth noting. Sincere or political rhetoric? That's what we'll explore in a moment. What's clear is that the destruction is unprecedented. One of the groups helping with the relief effort is the World Food Program of the United Nations. WFP Executive Director Etherin Cousin spent the weekend touring the regions around Tacloban and Cebu. She told me earlier that the devastation was profound.
I was at Katrina. I represent the United States during Haiti, and I can tell you that this is one of the worst disaster zones I've ever been in. This same time last week, you could not get into the city at all. We were able to reach 50,000 people in the entire affected area. By today, we've now reached almost 1 million people.
So what remains the biggest challenge now?
The biggest challenge now is going to be shelter. I was in a school where there were 200 families living in the school, which was probably close to about 2,000 people. And so we're talking about families lying side by side on the floor on mats. But what we're going to also need is to ensure that we can support the rehabilitation of the rice fields. Many of the rice paddies have been covered in mud. The planting season starts in December. If they don't get to plant in December of this year, come March of next year, they won't have any income at all. So you're talking about people who have lost everything from the typhoon who could potentially now lose their livelihoods if we can't help them.
Ms. Cousin, what about livestock? How badly did they fare in the typhoon?
Well, it's interesting. Livestock in these particular communities is not a significant part of the livelihood equation. It's much more agriculture and fish. You have a lot of fisher folk in these areas. And unfortunately, many of the fish ponds suffered the same type of damage as the rice paddies. And now they're full of mud and many of the fish were killed, which is going to detrimentally impact the fisher folk to continue to receive income.
Etherin Cousin, the executive director of the World Food Program, speaking with us from Manila. Thank you.
You're welcome.
As we mentioned earlier, the president of the Philippines, Benigno Aquino, has also flown to the disaster zone. In fact, President Aquino is still there in Tacloban, and he says he's not leaving until he's certain the people are being helped. Aquino also slammed local authorities, blaming them for not being prepared for the typhoon's destruction. But Aquino is himself the target of widespread criticism over the speed with which his government has reacted to the calamity. John Seidel is at the London School of Economics and knows the Philippines quite well. So President Aquino blamed local governments today for a lack of preparedness. Is the president now dealing with the destruction of a storm and entering a political fray?
Well, he's been in a political fray for some time now. His remarks in the media and the slowness of the national government in responding to the typhoon and its aftermath have landed him in hot water in terms of media coverage and disputes with local officials and national politicians who are his opponents and critics.
Give us some background here. I mean, Benigno Aquino, the president, he's the latest in the Aquino political dynasty. Who were the other leaders in the Aquino family, and what cues has he taken from his family?
Well, he's the son of two famous former Philippine politicians. His father was Senator Benigno Aquino Jr., who was the leader of the opposition to Marcos in the late 60s, early 1970s, and then was thrown in prison under martial law, remained in prison, and then was sent into exile, where he remained in the United States until he returned to the Philippines in 1983, and he was shot dead, assassinated on his arrival in Manila. That's what really got the ball rolling in terms of a mass movement that ended up forcing out then-President Ferdinand Marcos in 1986, with his widow, Corazon Aquino, running for president in early 1986 and cheated out of victory through fraud by Marcos, but then allowed to assume the presidency after a failed military rebellion in February of that year.
Hasn't the Aquino family typically been really populist leaders?
The Aquino family, or rather the Cuanco family, which is the wealthy family that the president now, his mother comes from, the Cuanco family, it's a landed family with a history of business and land ownership. So it has a kind of reputation for opposing dictatorship. And the current president has something of a reputation, at least until recently, of being a well-intentioned promoter of reform, someone who has no history of sort of personal corruption or avarice that might, you know, bring his reputation down.
Should we be seeing Aquino's arrival and promise to stay in Tacloban as a kind of campaign stop? I mean, when is the next presidential election?
The next presidential elections are in 2016. He can't run for office for a second term. The Constitution makes that impossible. He has a single six-year term. But Mar Rojas, the Secretary of Interior and Local Government, is the presumed anointed successor for Aquino. The problem, though, is that the Aquino administration has begun to lose its popularity. Mar Rojas is not particularly popular himself, and the current vice president, Jojo Binay, who hails from the opposition party, he's seen really as the front runner and has been seen as the front runner even before this crisis. So insofar as the typhoon, its aftermath, and the Aquino government's widely perceived weak, belated, ineffectual, maybe irresponsible response to the typhoon makes it all the more likely that President Aquino will be in a weak position to anoint a successor in 2016.
John Seidel, professor of international and comparative politics at the London School of Economics. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
The frustration with the government isn't limited to those living in the Philippines. Millions of Filipinos live abroad, and they're growing increasingly impatient with the relief effort. The World's Leo Hornack met with a group of Filipino expats in London.
When you're waiting for news of your family, sometimes it's the ordinary things that remind you most of home, like preparing a meal.
My family, I didn't hear from them for a few days. I was thinking, are they eating anything at this time? Are they hungry? Are they thirsty?
That's Kathleen Dar. She's one of about 30 Filipinos here in London who've crowded into one family's house to share food, thoughts and prayers for those back home.
I was feeling guilty throwing food, wasting food here, and people there are all hungry. I was just like in tears every day. It's overwhelming.
Everyone in this house tonight is either from Leyte or Samar, the two Philippine provinces most affected by the typhoon. And everyone has a story to share.
I am Renato, and I come from Giwan, Eastern Samar. My family members have been accounted for, except for two who didn't make it.
I'm Jarin Go. Now our definition of safe now is just being alive. So that's our operational definition of being safe. I managed to contact my mom very quickly yesterday. The signal was cut off. It was very difficult because you know, you have several questions in your mind which you want to ask her, but you were unable to ask because the signal wasn't really good. You know, the torture, the mental torture, the anguish, it is just too much, really.
They're also furious at the way the Philippine government has handled the aid effort and fear that some of the most desperate people are still being overlooked.
I feel so frustrated and disappointed, in particular with the president of the Philippines.
A woman named Irene Reyes says that even though the aid is starting to flow, it still might not reach those most in need.
I know there were so many overwhelming aid coming from different countries, but our concern now is if it really go to the victims of this typhoon.
At the heart of these concerns is the belief that some of the worst hit areas are places that the government in Manila has always overlooked. Places like Samar.
Samar gets the morsels that fall from the master's table. That is our general feeling. And in this calamity, it happened again.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you.
Before dinner is served, everyone gathers in the front room in front of a large figure of the Santo Niño de Tacloban, the city of Tacloban's protective spirit.
In this moment when we are grieving the loss of lives, of loved ones, the loss of everything, literally, we have nobody else to run to except God, because it is not over yet. It is not over yet.
For the world, I'm Leo Hornack.
Sometimes life is black and white. I'm speaking of the World Chess Championship underway right now in Chennai in India. Here's a quick update on where things stand at the moment. It's a setup for the interesting part of the story, so listen up. Norway's Magnus Carlsen has taken an impressive lead over local hero and reigning champion Vishwanathan Anand. Right now, Carlsen leads by a score of 4.5 to 2.5, and you can hear the Norwegian's confidence after his most recent win.
Obviously, I'm in a good mood now. I mean, I've won 2 games, and with 6 games to go, that's obviously a healthy lead.
Things look less rosy for Anand, obviously.
I mean, today's a heavy blow. I won't pretend otherwise. But nothing to be done. You just go on.
Back in Carlsen's home country of Norway, people are getting pretty stoked that one of their own may win the world chess crown. The Norwegian news site Aftenposten is even strutting its stuff. They've come up with a cool way to challenge chess players around the globe. It's launched an online chess tournament that amounts to Norway versus the rest of the world. In other words, anyone with a Norwegian internet address, .no, can vote on Norway's next move, and anyone logging in from outside Norway gets to vote on the rest of the world's next move. It's crowdsourcing meets chess, checkmate by online committee. Norway plays the white pieces and the rest of the world plays black. At last glance, the virtual white bishops and black knights were battling it out. 2,200 players were signed up, and the first game had already been compromised. Seems some Norwegian trolls, pretending to be on the international side, voted for some really bad moves. But the game goes on as long as the server doesn't crash. There are lots of ways to find the world's stories these days. One great way? The Flipboard app. Yep. Think radio becomes a magazine whose pages you can actually flip through and at the same time hear all the voices you know from the world. It's pretty darn cool, and it runs on your iPad, iPhone, or Android device. You can find that at flipboard.com/theworld. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com and by Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. I love mushrooms. Went hunting for mushrooms in France once, among the best times I've ever had. But seriously, how much would you pay for an edible fungus? Well, in Italy recently, well-heeled connoisseurs shelled out big bucks for some of the world's most sought-after spores. Angelica Marin reports from Alba, Italy.
Hong Kong via Skype.
90,000, thank you. 90,000.
Someone there just bid a jaw-dropping $120,000 for a lumpy, smelly fungus, which looks like an ugly potato and makes Michelin star chefs salivate. It is a rare white truffle.
Technically, it's an underground mushroom, but for everybody, it's a smell, a unique, fantastic smell. In the white truffle, you can have 120, 140 different smells.
Mauro Carbone is the director of Italy's National White Truffle Research Center and the official nose of the International White Truffle Auction in Alba, Italy. Carbone decides that truffle number 4 smells of garlic, onion, and honey. Gazing at the white truffles on silver platters, in person and virtually, are the rich and uber-rich from Italy and across the globe.
3, 2, 1, aggiudicato!
In the end, bidders paid $360,000 for 12 truffles. To Carbone, that's perfectly logical.
The white truffle is so expensive because it's very difficult to find. You can't cultivate it. You can find only what nature wants to produce.
White truffles are so sought after, in part because they only come out once a year, during the months of October and November. And master chef Marco Fornetti says, do believe the hype about the funky mushroom.
I think truffles are a sort of magic that is then transformed on your plate. Because truffles don't have strong flavors. What they do have are bold aromas that we intensify with certain ingredients that we use. But it's almost like an intellectual pleasure rather than a physical one. It's truly magical.
Magical and elusive. If you want one, you need to hunt for it. So I went out in the woods with a brawny hunter named Walter Tedesco and his secret weapon, a perky mixed-breed canine called Leo. Leo scouts a bed of leaves under a poplar tree. Nature has chosen the northern Italian Piedmont region and its damp and foggy forests as the perfect climate for truffles. And Walter says competition to find them is fierce.
It's really competitive when it comes to truffle hunting, not just because of how much they're worth, but because you want to find the right one, the most prestigious one, so you go out at night without a flashlight, without making a sound, so your competitors can't hear you.
So much that not even Leo is allowed to bark. Within minutes, Leo claws frantically at the damp earth. He has sniffed out a truffle the size of a mandarin, a few inches underground. Too small for the international truffle auction, but still worth $100 in the local market. Walter could well sell it, but this time, he says, he'd rather bring it home and eat it thinly shaved over a poached egg or his wife's fresh pasta. For The World, this is Angelica Marin, Alba.
Ever wondered what a $100,000 truffle looks like? Well, you can see pictures of one and of Leo the truffle hunting dog at PRI.org. Santa Claus arrived in the Netherlands over the weekend. They call him Sinterklaas there, and instead of elves, he's got a sidekick called Black Pete. This holiday character's appearance can be shocking if you're not from Holland. He wears black face, red lipstick, and an afro wig. It's like a low country minstrel show, and that's not a compliment. But despite the Netherlands' liberal reputation, this is one of the most popular Dutch traditions during the holidays. I asked the BBC's Anna Holligan in The Hague who Black Pete is supposed to be.
The tradition goes back around 300 years. Originally, according to historians, Black Pete was this kind of demonic character who was in chains, and he would capture the bad children, the naughty children, and put them in his sack and take them back to Spain, which is where apparently he came from. And as the years progressed, he turned into a freed slave. And people here say, you know, he's been liberated and Sinterklaas is his friend. And now, if you ask people now, how did this character come to have black skin? They say, well, he goes down the chimney. So it's just soot from the chimney. There are absolutely no racial undertones at all. And that's what the majority of people here in the Netherlands think about this whole controversy.
Do people buy that they just came down the chimney and got dirty story?
Not really. A minority group in the Netherlands approached the UN Council for Human Rights and explained their problem. The UN special representative wrote a letter to the Dutch government expressing its concerns, and their key point is that sometimes cultural rights and people's rights to express their culture that has been historically okay can sometimes be in conflict with human rights. This isn't a homogeneous country anymore. After the Second World War, there were lots of people coming from Turkey and Morocco, and people tell me that their kids are running home from school and trying to scrub their skin because they've been called Zwarte Piet in class.
Wow.
And it's painful for many people here.
But I got to say, here in the U.S., if something like Black Piet were to happen, I mean, it would be instantly criticized and shot down. Is it a matter of time before this ritual is no longer tolerated? I mean, is it a generational thing, do you think?
It may depend on the international pressure, but I think really, if this is ever to be abandoned, it will be down to the Dutch people deciding that they want to move on and that they recognize that for some minority groups now living in this country, calling this country home, it's no longer acceptable.
So Sinterklaas, with his Zwarte Piet in tow, arrived over the weekend in the Netherlands. How long does the party last?
He did arrive in the Netherlands over the weekend, and we were there witnessing the ship arriving, and there's a brass band of Black Piets playing, hundreds of them on this steamboat coming across, according to legend. It lasts until the 5th of December. So on the 5th of December, that's the date where the Black Piets come down the chimneys and you can leave your shoe by the fireplace and Black Piets will deliver gifts. Traditionally, a chocolate letter, leave them in your shoe by the fireplace.
A letter like the letter of the alphabet, right?
Exactly, like a letter of the alphabet. I'll have to bring an M over for you.
Please do.
Yes, but we're expecting to hear more from the UN towards the end of this month. So the debate is not going to go away.
Would the Dutch really take a steer from the UN if they said, you need to drop this?
It's hard to say. I was in a tattoo artist in Rotterdam speaking to people there about this, and I'd gone to meet this woman called Michelle who was having a Black Piet tattooed between her shoulder blades, this brightly colored, black-faced character. And the reason was because she believes it's her cultural right to express her culture as part of her human rights. Will they take a steer from the UN? I think we'll have to wait and see.
The BBC's Anna Holligan in The Hague. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, turning a wasteland in the heart of Moscow into a park, call it Extreme Makeover Post-Soviet Edition, plus the man who hunts down counterfeit wines in China. Talk about cat and mouse.
I have different identities, nationalities. I have different websites. I prepare myself quite well when I go into these situations.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at stopdiabetesnow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Remember when military leaders were heroes? General Dwight David Eisenhower later became a president. Storman Norman Schwarzkopf had his moment of hero worship after Operation Desert Storm in Iraq. So did Colin Powell before becoming Secretary of State. Well, in Egypt right now, it's General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi who seems to be riding a wave of popularity, at least among some Egyptians. Here to tell us what's going on is Borzu Daragahi. He's with the Financial Times, based in Cairo, and a frequent contributor to The World. So for all intents and purposes, Borzu, General Sisi is the leader of Egypt following the ouster he engineered of democratically elected Mohamed Morsi. How do you rise up to the level of star so suddenly?
Well, I think that he emerged at a time when people were very desperate for some kind of leadership. Many people were very upset. I would say, a kind of overwhelming majority of Egyptians, although that's not scientifically provable, were upset with the presidency of Mohamed Morsi. And he came out, he was very decisive. He tapped into long-standing aspects of Egyptian culture. Go back to the days of Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was also a military man. And, people just were looking for a hero, and he was there at the right time in the right place. He said the right things, and he was tough-minded in a way a certain type of Egyptian really likes.
Right, and the admiration of General Sisi, it's not hyperbole. What are the symptoms that you've seen of Sisi fever?
Well, you have, for example, a chocolatier in downtown Cairo that sells chocolates with Sisi's face on it. You have people who put up portraits of Sisi on their taxi cabs and in front of their homes. I saw a video clip someone showed me of a sexy Egyptian woman wearing a bikini and dancing rather provocatively as she held up a poster of Sisi. You have people even naming their children Sisi in an attempt to sort of honor him and tap into his seeming glamour.
And tomorrow is General Sisi's birthday, I gather. Does that mean today Sisi fever is really over the top?
Yeah, you get that sense a little bit. I have a feeling that it might be dying down a little bit, that the glow and affection for him might be sort of dissipating in the light of day, so to speak. But in fact, yes, tomorrow is his birthday. It's also the day, the two-year anniversary of the day that police, under the authority of the military, opened fire on mostly peaceful protesters on Mohammed Mahmoud Street in downtown Cairo. And there's an attempt to commemorate that day as well. I would also like to say something. I think there's a certain artificiality to the Sisi fervor.
Mm.
In Egypt, you have these private channels, these private television channels that are highly influential, owned by big business people who have very strong ties to the deposed regime of Hosni Mubarak, who have really strong interests in not having the status quo upended and their business pursuits exposed to the light of day. And they are playing a key instrumental role in whipping up support for Sisi. Perhaps people in Egypt are not as media savvy and sophisticated as people in the West. And, when they see someone they kind of like on television speaking glowingly about Sisi, they may just buy into that uncritically.
Borzu, put this whole kind of Sisi love or whether he's losing his luster into the context of what's been going on lately in Egypt. I mean, politically, what's going on and how is the Sisi love kind of playing against that?
Well, you have a sort of period of uncertainty with this interim government that was essentially named directly or indirectly by Sisi. And they're trying to draw up a new constitution. We get drips and drabs about what's going on in the process of drawing up this constitution. We hear, for example, that the military is sort of pressuring the people who are drawing up this constitution to give them rather extraordinary privileges and immunity from certain types of prosecution and so on, as well as certain powers, for example, to bring civilians before military courts. And so one of the things that this Sisi mania is contributing to is actually cementing certain anti-democratic tendencies that are emerging in this transitional period before you have elections.
Borzu, on another note, apparently in Tahrir Square there's a monument that's being built. I'm kind of scratching my head, though, as to who or what it commemorates. Why is it being built, and how do Egyptians feel about it?
For now, it's just the base of a monument. Many see this as an attempt by those who committed crimes against the Egyptian people to co-opt the memory and legacy of Tahrir Square, and they view this rather cynically and skeptically.
Borzu Daragahi, correspondent with the Financial Times in Cairo. Thanks a lot, Borzu. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
A different sort of public space in Russia is about to get a makeover. Currently, it's a vast, vacant lot in the heart of Moscow, right in the shadow of the Kremlin. In Soviet times, it was the site of the hulking Rossiya Hotel, but the hotel was demolished years ago. Now the plan is to turn the space into a park. Zaradye Park is the new name. The New York design firm Diller, Scofidio, and Renfro has a job. They're the same people who created the Highline Park in Manhattan. Partner Charles Renfro told me about the firm's design for the Moscow Park.
At Zaradye, we're building on top of ruins right in the middle of Moscow. It couldn't be more of an urban and almost industrial site. Our primary idea was to bring four different ecological sites from Russia, the tundra, the steppe, the forest, and the wetlands, and create them as sort of artificial natural landscapes, and then overlay the urban conditions that surround the site, the cobblestones of Red Square.
And Red Square isn't too far away from this park, is it?
No, well, it's the extension of Red Square on the south side of St. Basil's Cathedral is immediately adjacent to our park. Mm. And the same surface that forms Red Square is the surface that meets the park. So we bring that in and merge that up with the forest to make a wholly surreal new kind of experience that's at once urban and once at once green.
So what remain the most challenging parts of putting this park together now for you?
Well, there is a very complex site with a complex history, and it's a history that dates back hundreds and hundreds of years. And I think trying to reconcile the multiple histories with the current desires is going to prove very interesting. And when I say histories, I'm also referring to the Stalinist history, which is a kind of notable moment in the park, too. So it's the past histories and the future histories that we're trying to reconcile in the park, and I think that's going to be interesting and challenging.
I'm just curious, did you walk around a lot of parks in Moscow, and what was the kind of the oddest use of a park that you saw while you were there?
Oh, I can't really say that I saw anything particularly odd, but I think one of the things that happens in Moscow parks and public spaces, people are very respectful of the curb, let's say, the division between the paved and the green surface. Nobody really, you know, steps on or gets in touch with nature. I mean, just a piece of grass where citizens in the United States would be, oh, look, it's a lawn, let's go out there and throw a frisbee. In Moscow, if there's a piece of cultivated grass, people are like, oh, wow, look, there's a green thing to look at. So in a way, it's less what they're doing and more of what they aren't doing.
Is that going to be a challenge in and of itself? Because, I mean, the High Line actually kind of invites not people to go stomp on the weeds, but to stomp on the grasses and plants, but it invites you to be a part of that kind of wilderness.
Yeah, I love that you called them weeds, which is true.
I was thinking of the beach grasses. They kind of
no, it's all
seals.
Weeds. I mean, most of the material was recovered or discovered from the line as it had become overgrown. I think there will be a new culture that will be born in Zaradye, as there was a new culture born in New York City with the High Line. New York City folks didn't know how to use certain kinds of public space very well. I mean, Central Park, you know, invited people out to play frisbee and do their various kinds of activities. But we really didn't have a park that was about doing nothing except for being there. And I think the High Line is the first New York City park that's sort of just about for being there, strolling. And likewise, Zaradye will have a similar mandate to teach Muscovites how to be in public space and with nature in a different way.
Charles Renfro speaking with us from his New York City offices of Diller, Scofidio, and Renfro. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You can see what Moscow's new Zarudye Park will look like at PRI.org. It does not look good for immigration reform at the moment. The House is refusing to take up the comprehensive bill passed by the Senate, but some immigration advocates are not giving up. They're trying to move things along by putting heavy pressure on a few key Republican members of the House. The World's Jason Margolis reports on their efforts in Colorado.
In the city of Aurora, right next to Denver, Republican Representative Mike Kaufman is the target. Eugenio Rodarte walks the streets of this heavily Latino community with his clipboard, stopping people and asking if they support immigration reform. When he finds a woman who says yes, he quickly pulls out his cell phone.
This is Mike Kaufman office? Okay, hi. I'm calling from Aurora.
Rodarte, who is working with the group Mi Familia Vota, hands the Spanish-speaking woman his phone and a short script. He does the translation for the congressman's staffer on the other end of the line.
Le pido al señor congresista.
I ask to the Congress Mike Kaufman.
Que apoye la nueva propuesta HR-15 por una reforma migratoria.
To support the HR-15 for immigration reform.
HR-15 is the Democrat-backed immigration reform bill that largely mirrors the Senate's proposal that passed this summer. Rodarte has been placing a lot of these calls recently. His group is also bringing people directly to Kaufman's regional office. Rodarte is convinced their strategy is working. He says Kaufman has already come a long way.
I think because he got so many messages from the community, he got his machine so full every day that finally he came out public in a newspaper, Denver Post, and he announced that he is going to support immigration reform.
Kaufman wrote that op-ed in July. He reiterated standard conservative points, like calling for more secure borders. Kaufman also said that children who were brought to the U.S. illegally should get a pathway to citizenship, and that adults here in good standing should be eligible for a provisional visa to remain in the U.S. That's a big step for a Republican member of the House. But immigration reform advocates like Derek Ruiz, also with Mi Familia Vota, say Kaufman now needs to put his words into action and support an actual bill if he wants Latino votes next year.
The community is not dumb. they're very smart. So they know, they will know that Kaufman did not step up and did not champion immigration reform for the community. And, you know, 20% of his constituents are immigrants.
Kaufman may need those votes. His district was redrawn last year and now has a lot more Latinos. That puts Kaufman in a bind. Pursue Latino voters or stand with the conservative base. Kaufman turned down repeated interview requests for this story. His website offers no details on his stance on immigration reform. Christine Marcus Hudson, executive director of the Mi Casa Resource Center in Denver, has met with Kaufman in Washington.
I think that Mike Kaufman is a pragmatic person, and I think that he is also cognizant of the changing demographics of the community that he represents.
But in the next breath, Marcus Hudson says she's cynical that Kaufman and other House Republicans will get anything done anytime soon. She says they're too worried about losing their seats to more conservative Republican primary challengers next year.
It is very, very exhausting. God bless the people that are still out there working hard on this. But I think everyone would agree some of the wind has been knocked out of the sails.
Kaufman may have another reason not to sign onto an immigration reform bill. The damage to the Republican brand with Latinos may already be done. Immigration reform activists insist that if Republicans get this issue off the table, Latinos will again consider voting for their party. Colombian immigrant and restaurant owner Joaquin Contreras says it's already too late.
It won't make a difference because the Republicans, they always talk about money, cutting taxes for rich people.
He says those kinds of policies don't attract lower income or even middle class people like most Latinos in places like Aurora. If an immigration bill doesn't get passed this year, an increasingly likely scenario, advocates say the fight isn't over. They insist they're not going away. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Just ahead, file under Dirty Jobs, tracking down fake wines in China on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We've all gotten used to having a lot of what we buy come with a Made in China label, and that includes the fake stuff. Luxury watches, designer clothing, top brand electronics. It seems China is infamous for mastering the art of mastering copies of anything. Attorney Nick Bartman has spent his career investigating counterfeiting in China. His latest focus is counterfeit wine. For the past few years, Bartman has gone undercover to study China's not-quite-legit wine industry.
I have different identities, nationalities. I have different websites. I prepare myself quite well when I go into these situations. So I went up to the wine-growing country, which is on the East Coast. And then I just kept myself busy in amongst those types of growers to find out what they were doing and how they were working.
And when you go to the vineyard, how did you present yourself? I am a magazine writer. What do you say?
No, they see me as an investor in Chinese retail. Obviously, I need to look as if I'm a reasonably sized customer, otherwise they're not going to talk for long.
And you have to do this undercover because counterfeiting is such a sensitive subject in China?
For counterfeiters, when they know they're doing something wrong, of course, they're going to have a pretty strong defense mechanism, so you can't get through their firewall. But our job is to get through that firewall, getting involved with them, going out for meals with them, drinking with them, spending days with them, getting them into a position where you start to learn their inner secrets. And that's what I did, and that's how I began to get my results.
So who is actually buying or was buying this fake wine? I assume there's still counterfeit wine being produced in China.
China has been growing wine for 2,000 years, but even today, it's not a drink of a preference of many. The average worker, labourer or farmer never drink wine, whereas in other countries, that's absolutely the reverse. The newer rich, the middle management, business-type people, they will be the buyers. I think a lot of Western people don't know how much they know about wine. Some people say, well, I know nothing about wine, but if you give them a bad one, they know about it. China's not like that. Many people new to drinking wine didn't actually know what the taste should be.
Nick, you drank a lot of counterfeit wine in your research. What was kind of the range of taste among these fakes?
Well, standard taste was so dry that your tongue would stick to the roof of your mouth. You'd end up with a sort of red tannin around your lips and your teeth, and you'd end up with a class headache at the end of it as well. So some of it was extremely obvious. There was some chemical wine, a liquid that is mixed to give a taste of wine by laboratory performance and then have alcohol mixed into it and so forth. Pour that into, let's say, a napkin. You don't get any little bits of grape or anything, sediment at all. It's an absolutely clear wine, as if it's come out of a laboratory. And that would be quite horrible. Somebody who says they know nothing about wine, if they tasted some of the wines I had to taste, they would immediately go, there's something extremely wrong with this.
Nick Bartman, attorney and expert in counterfeits. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
As far as controversial topics go, you can always count on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Not a lot of common ground there. That's the macro view. But Israelis and Palestinians do sometimes discover common ground on a more personal level. Take the two concert pianists, one Israeli, the other Palestinian, who combine their musical talents to form Duo Amal. Israeli-Palestinian collaboration is quite rare on the classical music scene. Reporter Daniel Estrin tells us how these two 30-year-old piano prodigies joined forces for peace and discovered some unexpected musical benefits along the way.
The Israeli-Palestinian piano duo began exactly where the Israeli-Palestinian Oslo Peace Accords began, in Oslo. Israeli piano prodigy Yaron Kolberg was asked to play a concert there 5 years ago.
They said, oh, this concert is going to be for peace, something like this. It's going to be with a lot of diplomats, or also Arab diplomats and stuff like that.
So he thought, why not invite Bishara Haroni to play together? Bishara was a Palestinian pianist his age, and it was a concert for peace, and, well, as Bishara says, they were considered the top Israeli and Palestinian pianists of their generation.
I knew that Yaron is one of the best, if not the best, pianists in his age.
And for sure, in the other side, Palestinian side, I was almost the only one. It doesn't matter if I'm good or not good.
Oh, but he's good. When they first got together to rehearse, things just clicked.
We almost didn't need to rehearse, actually. We communicated so well, and we understood each other so good, and everything just worked very well. Our feeling was good.
Here they are playing Prokofiev. It's hard to imagine that these two pianists, so synchronized in their music making, grew up in such different worlds. Bishara, from the Arab town of Nazareth in northern Israel, grew up listening to Eastern Oriental music, and he considers himself a proud Palestinian. Yaron was raised in Jerusalem, and his mother is a classical musician, and he considers himself a patriotic Israeli.
I never had a true Arab friend. I didn't really know how it is, you know, to grow up as a Palestinian in Nazareth and stuff like that. So it was a very interesting process for me. I learned a lot from him. We just got to know each other, so we got to learn from each other too.
2 years ago, they decided to make Duo Amal their career. Yaron moved to Berlin, where Bishara was living. He moved into the same apartment building. And they began spending hours upon hours together, rehearsing, but also duking it out. They are, after all, an Israeli and a Palestinian. But they're also a musical rarity. There aren't that many professional piano duos out there.
Before we started the duo, we weren't aware of many of the variety of pieces that there are. So first of all, there's quite a lot of original pieces that are not often played.
So they've resurrected piano works by Rachmaninoff and Mozart and Stravinsky that are rarely performed. They also commissioned original works, a piece from Berlin-based Palestinian composer Samir Oded Tamimi, and this piece from U.S.-based Israeli composer Avner Dorman, called Karsi Lama. Israeli-Palestinian politics have been unavoidable. Activists at a Palestinian cultural festival in London threatened to picket unless Yaron was taken off the bill. They've tried to arrange a performance in the West Bank, but Palestinian concert organizers have been hesitant. And when they gave their first performances in Israel last month with the Israel Philharmonic, people asked point blank, aren't you just a kumbaya gimmick?
The music is for us the main thing, before anything else.
People who treat it or who suspect it as some kind of gimmick, they stop suspecting it when they hear us play.
Seeing them play is also a dramatic sight, and a symbolic one, too. Two grand pianos nestled together in a yin-yang position. From the audience, it looks like one long, shiny black mass. An Israeli and a Palestinian sit on each end, so far apart, but their fingers race across the keys, so in sync. Interpret it as you will, but sometimes two pianos are better than one. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
That's our program today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.